Joining us again on the Wintrust Business Lunch is Michael Miller, the economics professor at Western Washington University, professor emeritus over at DePaul here in Chicago. Michael, I hope you're doing well.
I am doing well. I just spent 4 days on the coast of Oregon, so I'm very rested.
Yeah, what's that like?
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful area. I went to a lot of museums, some stuff relating to maritime and logging and aviation. It was a great time.
Yeah, sounds lovely.
And wandered the beaches.
Yeah. Are those like beaches like I'm used to, or are they more rocky and cavernous, and it's more a view than it is a place to go swimming?
Along Washington and Oregon, there are areas that are just beautiful, soft sand beaches. Now, the water's cold because we're, you know, at 50 degrees latitude, but the beaches are quite beautiful. And they're very deep. So we had a great time.
I don't know if in your travels you had time to catch up with what Kamala Harris and Joe Biden did yesterday, but they announced that they are going to lower prescription drug prices on a handful of drugs for Americans. Is the government able to do that? And if so, why haven't we done more to control drug prices in this country?
Well, the government can in this sense. They can't set the prices, but they can negotiate, and they'll simply say that we won't buy the product from you unless you sell it to us at a particular price. The government has never done that before through Medicare or Medicaid. We've just not done that, or the VA. And if you look at other countries, what makes Americans raise their eyebrows is if you look at the same drug sold in other countries, the price is much, much lower. And they wonder, why are they so high here? So we could import the drugs, say, from Canada, from another country where they're very low priced, and that would then allow us to buy the product in the United States at the lower price. But the problem is that the outcome that we have, which has the foreign prices so low, is just because of the nature of the market, in that these countries have said they won't buy them unless the prices are low. We've not done that. But these higher prices we sell essentially subsidize the foreign lower prices. And it's the only way that the firms, the pharmaceuticals, can actually make money. So if we do negotiate these lower prices and they continue to sell the drugs overseas at these lower prices, the estimate of some research that was done by some Fed economists is that profits in pharmaceuticals will fall about 20%. And that will lead to a dramatic reduction in the amount of research on new drugs and new answers to medical problems. Hmm. And while I was in Oregon, I did notice just in the Wall Street Journal yesterday an article saying several pharmaceuticals have already begun to reduce their R&D expenditures in anticipation of these lower prices.
So we're subsidizing Canadian pharmaceuticals?
Absolutely. The only way that the drug can be profitable and be sold to the Canadians at a particular lower price is if we pay a higher price. So in some sense, the price we pay is related to how well Canada, Germany, other places negotiate. So what's interesting, these economists came up with an interesting idea. Is it possible that you and I could pay less for our pharmaceuticals, these particular drugs, and at the same time there would be enough profit in it for the pharmaceuticals to continue their R&D? And the answer they came up with was a single price. In other words, they would not sell it to Canada at a different price than they sell it to the U.S. They would sell it to all customers at the same price. And the estimate is that you and I would end up paying less, which I think is the intention, certainly, of Vice President Harris. But in these other countries, they estimate that the cost of the drug in their markets would go up as much as 300%. Mm-hmm. So you see the subsidy that we, in a sense, pay so that these other countries can have this lower price is very substantial. And I think Americans have, you know, said no more of this.
Yeah, you can imagine how we feel about that. That doesn't make any sense. And it would seem to me like if they did set a price and everybody had to pay the same price in every country, that it would raise the price in those countries somewhat, but maybe not so dramatically, because we would still have to pay that price too, that they couldn't still make a profit, or that the Canadians could still afford it. Well, then what do you make of America? Man, when I get to be king, Michael. But what do you make of Americans just crossing the border and getting their drugs from Canadian pharmacies or firms?
Well, that's what you're able to do that, but then you have to question. You don't know that firm. The word I've been told is that you must be very careful of the quality of the drugs you get from outside the country. You can hear that they sell drug X or Y or Z at a generic price of so much per pill, but do you really know who it is that's selling you those pills? And I've seen some studies that have been done that shown that the quality of the drugs coming out of Europe sold to us through these overseas expenditures are of subpar quality. And so you may not actually be getting the dosage that you really want. So,
I know that some of these...
I thought it was an interesting proposal.
I know that some of these companies are not American-based, but...
Oh, yeah, that's correct.
But I just wonder if the reason we don't negotiate lower prices is because we're protecting the American manufacturers of these and enabling them to get rich off of all of our backs.
I think that's part of it. And the other one is simply that we allow prices. We allow prices to be set more by the market than many other countries are doing. Yeah. And therefore, they say to us, I'm sorry, this is what we have to charge you if we're going to make a profit. What Americans don't know is that the other countries are making these deals and that we're subsidizing them. And as that becomes clear, I think there will be a change over the next couple of years in the policy of pricing, which will cause prices to rise overseas, but allow us then to have slightly lower prices here.
I'm glad you told us about that. I didn't know about that. Now I'm going to change my vote when I'm in Canada. On the Wintrust Business Lunch, we're talking to economics professor Mike Miller. Mike, talk to me just a little bit about inflation and some of the numbers that I'm hearing. Seems like we're under 3%, close to the number the Fed wants. But then again, everybody seems to look at this pie differently. What do you say about it?
Well, we're making progress. Of course, the target is 2%, and the Fed has made it clear they are not going to change the target to make their job easier. They're not going to raise it to 2.5 or something. So 2% is the target. We're currently on a year-over-year basis at 2.9, and it has fallen, I think, now 4 or 5 months in a row, which is good news. But we have to understand that in June of 1 year ago, a year ago June, it was 3%. So in a year, we've only fallen 0.1%. But what the Fed is looking forward doing is looking not backward as much as looking forward. And based upon the weakness they're seeing in the labor market and some weakness in manufacturing and so forth, that the answer may be now that it's in the twos and it appears that we're going to continue to make progress, that the Fed will at their next meeting in September lower interest rates, probably 0.25%, not a half, especially given those retail sales figures that came out yesterday. It appears that the consumer continues to spend quite smartly, which is keeping the economy afloat. And they also noted that the first-time claims came out yesterday, which is a very early signal of weakness in the labor market. First-time claims for unemployment insurance have improved over the past couple of weeks, which is a good sign that we're not falling into recession. We're certainly not in recession now, and there is concern that we could be. That's a sign that recession would be a little bit further off, and therefore the Fed will probably move about 0.25%.
Well, I guess you can't have everything. I mean, a lot of those numbers sound good, but a lot of people want to see the cost of borrowing for a home to go down, and that seems to be the last one. But I wonder if, knowing all of that, we'd make this trade. That is, inflation under control, unemployment manageable, the markets seem to be stable, you know, despite what happened 2 Mondays ago. I wonder if this is about as good as it can get. Or is there some fix that we need to make, Mike?
Well, I would like to see on one side, I would, because you know, what we're doing is we're fighting inflation predominantly through the, what we would call the demand side. The interest rate is a very blunt instrument in dealing with spending, in that you and I don't always respond the way that the Fed would like us to. And therefore, them raising interest rates, or lowering them, is their only tool that they truly have. But you know that inflation is tied to a supply side issue too. It has to do with how many goods are out there. So encouraging of entrepreneurship and reductions in regulations can raise the amount of production that is done. And as these goods come to market, and they're done so very efficiently, the prices that are charged can go up more slowly, if up at all. And that, of course, would reduce the amount of future inflation. So I would like to see some supply side actions. That would be through, again, government policy, dealing with regulation, entrepreneurship, using tax policy to encourage people to invest in things that will raise productivity. So a little bit of that would go a long way.
Yeah. Well, and let me ask you about
the two
that.
Of them. Sure.
Go ahead. Between the two of them. My question was,
between the two of them, we would completely fight inflation from both the supply side and from the demand side.
Do you like the idea of subsidizing first-time home buyers with the $25,000 credit?
Wow. You know, we do put a whole lot into housing, and the reason we do is because it is so important within that stable housing creates stable households, which creates stable neighborhoods. And so it's always been a very important part of the American experience. So, it's been very tough to buy a house right now between the down payment and the high interest rates. And then prices, as you know, have not fallen very much. Actually, they haven't fallen at all because the market is so tight. Like me, I certainly wouldn't even consider selling. I have a mortgage at 3 3/8%. Why would I ever sell or even refinance? Yeah. And therefore, houses aren't going on the market, which keeps prices higher. So a subsidy, you know, it almost has socioeconomic effects as much as just economic. And it could be worth the trouble.
We'll talk about this more next time. But to what degree is greedflation spurring inflation?
Well, you know, in our talks over the years, during the pandemic, there were several cases where greedflation was occurring, where firms were raising prices just because they could, and we actually did talk about them. But it turned out that it was only happening in a couple industries, and it was only temporary, to use the word, it was transitory. And since then, the amount of greedflation, where it is simply firms raising prices because they can, has declined. And some economists did a study. They looked at what are called aggregate markup. Of course, firms take what does it cost for them to make their product, and then they add a markup on that, which would be, in a sense, their profit. And what is believed by some is that this markup is unusually high. And, of course, it could be. And it has been a couple times during the pandemic. These economists found, though, to explain inflation, the markup process being high would have to be true across all goods, which is what's in that, you know, the basket of goods that we use to measure inflation. And they found no evidence whatsoever. They found in today's world right now, there are a few isolated places where markup is higher than you would expect. But on average, across all different kinds of goods and services, the amount of markup is not any different than it has been in past recoveries and expansions. So I think, I know Vice President Harris is focusing on this, that she wants to go after greedflation. I just don't think that's going to be the answer, because you're going after something that really isn't that important in the overall picture.
Mike Miller is an economist, joins us regularly on WGN Radio. He's a DePaul guy. Now he's at Western Washington University. Mike, we'll call on you again. Thank you as always.
You're welcome, John. I enjoy it.
John Williams here. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. You're listening to WGN Radio. So the world is about to change in real estate, or is it? Will you notice any difference if you're at an open house or if you're closing, say, on a house tomorrow or anytime thereafter? Let's talk about that with Laura Ellis, the Chief Strategy Officer, the Executive Vice President and President of the Residential Sales at Baird & Warner. Laura, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me back.
Last time we spoke, we said we need to speak when this change is about to go into effect. Catch us up on what's happened.
So as of midnight tonight, some of the fundamental rules around the real estate industry are changing, and they're pretty significant changes for many years, decades. Things have worked in a manner where buyers would, find an agent, contact an agent, go look at houses, and real estate agents were paid their commission through something called cooperative commission, which was offered in the multiple listing service. Well, as of tonight, for buyers, after midnight, if they're going to go out and tour a home with a real estate agent, the rules are now that they must have a written buyer agency agreement in place with their agent before touring any homes. And also, at midnight tonight, there will no longer be cooperative commissions between agents shared through the MLS. The MLS will have no field for offering a commission to a cooperating agent. So what that really means is for buyers, the biggest change that they're going to see is that when they want to go look at a house, before seeing that house, they're going to need to sit down with an agent. An agent's going to be required to have them sign that written agreement. So that's probably the first biggest thing that buyers are going to experience, and it's vastly different.
What will that agreement say?
The agreement will specify exactly how the agent is being compensated. The agent and the prospective buyer will negotiate, because commissions are negotiable. So they will come into an agreement of what that fee is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the past, it was believed by buyers and reasonable to assume that it wasn't costing the buyer anything to go out and buy a house because the seller was paying the commission. So the seller paid the commission, when the seller listed a home with a listing agent, they would agree to whatever they negotiated, 5%, 6%, 7%, whatever that percentage was. And then that listing agent would offer usually half of that, roughly half, out to a buyer's agent to bring a buyer. So it was commonly thought that the seller paid the commission. Well, the reality of this is that the commissions are all paid from the money that the buyer brings to the closing table to complete the purchase. So it can be argued that that commission is really part of the transaction, and a buyer is actually paying a commission. So the rules moving forward are that the buyer needs to have a transparent, clear understanding of what the commission is that they are paying to their agent at the time that they purchase the home.
I understand that, but then how does the selling agent get compensated?
Well, the sellers are going to, when they list a home with a listing agent, they negotiate just the listing side of the commission. So in the past, perhaps a listing agent and a seller would agree to would agree to a 5% commission.
Yeah.
Today, it may be 2.5 or 3. So the seller pays the seller's agent, the buyer pays the buyer's agent.
And I suppose, does it depend on the house or the agents? I mean, you may say 2.25, I may say 3. Does it just depend on who you're working with or the home you're trying to buy?
Yeah. It actually is going to depend on who the buyer chooses to work with, and whomever that agent is, they will negotiate and agree on a commission amount.
Do you think somebody comes out ahead on this? Who is this most advantageous to, the buyer or the seller? And I'm not speaking about the agents. I'll ask about them, too. But the buyer and the seller of the properties, who comes out ahead, or is it a wash?
I really believe it's a wash, John. And the reason I do is that commissions again, you know, we always said that it's the seller paid it because that's where it showed up on the closing statement. But in fact, the commission has always been part of the transaction. It has flowed from the transaction. I do believe buyers and sellers are both going to come out ahead from the viewpoint of transparency. Transparency, yeah. Understanding. Buyers need to work with real estate professionals the same way that sellers work with real estate professionals, whereby a seller sits down, has a meeting with a prospective listing agent. They walk them through the process. They agree on the compensation and they sign an agreement. Well, now that is exactly the way that buyers should be working and will need to be working with a buyer's agent. In other words, instead of, hey, I want to go see this house, I just call an agent and they meet me out at the house, that can't really happen any longer. The buyer's going to need to sit down and really interview someone for the job of representing them, representing their interests, and then also agree on whatever the fee will be.
Which sounds a little more cumbersome. I don't know if I love that. I like the idea of just jumping in the car and driving around, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's going to be the biggest change that the consumer in purchasing a home is going to experience. Consumers or buyers can certainly still go to open houses. They can walk into open houses. But they'll need to understand that most likely the agent sitting in that open house, particularly if it's a listing agent, they don't represent the buyer at all. And so they've got to be careful that they don't disclose any personal confidential information, especially if they really like that.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, say it was 6%. I think plenty of us who bought and sold homes have paid 6 or maybe 5. But for math's sake, if it's 6, I'm going to pay 3. You're going to pay 3. That used to be the way it was split anyway. So I wonder if the numbers all kind of are going to come out the same. I know you said you think it's kind of a wash, right?
I do.
And what if the circumstance where I'm paying my agent as a buyer, but the seller is not using one? Does it stay, say, at my negotiated 2.5 or 3%, and the other side doesn't pay anything?
Yeah, the biggest behavior change is for real estate agents is exactly what you just summed up right there, John. The buyer and the buyer's agent agree to compensation, and there's no connection to then what the seller and the seller's agent have agreed to. So in that instance, the buyer's agent would just negotiate very aggressively and thoroughly on behalf of that buyer. It doesn't matter what the seller's obligations are, and vice versa. If a buyer should come in, this listing agent it's not going to be relevant to the listing agent how much that buyer's agent is being paid any longer. That's between
the
buyer's
agent. One last thing, Laura. What's the numbers that you are hearing? Do you have an expectation about what these contracts are going to look like? Is it going to be 2.5 on either side, 3? Is it going to be 2? What kind of number are we – what sort of number should I reasonably expect now?
I think you should reasonably expect that every real estate company out there is going to set their own policies, and every real estate agent is going to negotiate. I wish I could tell you for sure what that's going to look like a year from now. We're going to have to really watch the market. I know at Baird & Warner, we're spent a lot of time. It's been 6 months where we've aggressively been training our buyer's agents so that they can really explain the process, explain and prove the value that they bring to the buyer. But those commissions are completely negotiable. They are not
right.
set by the industry.
Okay, so I was just about to say, well, at Baird & Warner, are you all going to charge 2.5 or 3%? But maybe if I negotiate with you, the realtor, more aggressively than the other guy, maybe I'll get a different rate than the other guy, which I guess was always the case, huh?
Yes, it was always the case. Yeah, it was always the case. What I think is going to happen here, John, and this is where I think the consumer's really going to win out, is that the level of skill and professionalism that is going to be demanded and required from the real estate agent is only increasing. And that's a really good thing. It's a great thing for consumers. This is the biggest purchase of their life. Crazy complications, very complicated Anyone who's bought or sold knows it can be a real pain, and it can be difficult. So having that trusted advisor who is negotiating on your behalf, all the fiduciary responsibilities, and also yeah. has the experience to navigate that bumpy road, those are the agents that are going to do very, very well. The agents in our industry, and it's a big, big industry, the ones who, you know, we've got a lot of people in the real estate industry that are sort of spare time or part time. I think over time they're going to leave the business because they're not going to have the time and the desire to, improve their skill level.
Yeah,
so
I understand.
For the consumer, I think it's good.
Laura Ellis at Baird & Warner. Really interesting, Laura. We'll visit again another day, I'm sure. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
More business news on the Business Lunch now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The CEO of Chicago-based Kellanova will get a big payout after a merger with the Mars Candy Company. Mars announced plans this week to buy Kellanova, the Kellogg spinoff, for $36 billion. Cranes reports Kellanova's CEO, Steve Cahillane, is in line for a nearly $81 million payout when he exits after the deal closes. He's been CEO for just a short time. It's only been a year since Kellanova split from Kellogg. During that period, the company's net sales climbed 4% and the stock price increased 33%. Kellanova makes Cheez-It crackers, Rice Krispie treats, and Pop-Tarts. Mars makes Snickers and other candy bars. Rivian Automotive has reportedly paused production of the electric commercial van for Amazon. The company is dealing with a parts shortage in its supply chain. The temporary production halt began earlier this month at its factory in Downstate Normal. The report didn't say which components are in short supply, but the company has said it plans to recover all of the missed production. No timeline was provided. Bloomberg reports production of the R1 electric pickup and SUV models is unaffected. This is the latest of several production issues impacting Rivian as it tries to boost production output. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
And with the business of food, Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And it's a Mr. Fizz Friday, and Jim Fizzell, our gardening guru, is on with us. I've got another listener question for you, Jim. Are you up for that?
Yep.
This one's a little weird, I'll tell you. After, we thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, Jim, we've got Jonas from Northbrook who emailed me asking why his shoes turn rusty when he's walking through the grass. What's up with that?
Oh, boy, it's not rust coming from your watering system or anything like that. This is a common problem this time of year. It happens to be a fungus disease. We just call it rust because the spores that come off of that look like rust. And when they get on your shoes and so forth, they are rusty. Now, the problem is that the grass has a disease growing on the leaves that occurs this time of the year when temperatures are moderate. We don't have a lot of rain, but we have heavy dew at night. That allows the spores to germinate and to grow on the leaves. Now, the control of this thing is not to get your sprayer out there and spray some fungicides, but to get the grass growing. And the disease occurs because the grass has slowed down due to the time of year and also probably due to the fact that not much fertilizer is left from the treatments earlier in the season. The way to solve the problem is, first of all, get the grass growing. That means that you need to fertilize it, and then you need to water it. If you do that, the grass will grow very nicely, and it's going to begin growing this stuff out far enough that when you mow, you will cut it off. And once you begin cutting it off before it matures, you won't have the problem anymore. So the answer is fertilize, water, and then mow at 2.5 inches, and you need to mow often enough that you only mow an inch or an inch and a half of the blade each time. Now, that will solve the problem usually in a couple of weeks. It's not a disease where you've got to get out and spray. It's a disease that's an interesting one and just occurs at this time of year.
Mr. Fizz, Jim Fizzell, our gardening guru. Thank you, sir. On the food calendar, we celebrate another agricultural product.
Yo, ho, ho, and a bottle of rum.
It's National Rum Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
So you can get a Domino's pizza delivered and Malnati's just about anywhere. But what if you wanted to get a Pequot's or a Nancy's or a steak from Gibson's downtown? Who's going to deliver that to you in Plainfield? Well, now there's an app for that. And joining us on the Wintrust Business Lunch is the guy that came up with this, because once upon a time during the pandemic, he wanted a Pequot's pizza, if I understand the story correctly. Our guest is Alan Schulman, the CEO of Dwell social. Hi, Alan, you're on.
Hey, John, how are you?
What a good idea.
Well, I mean, it's exactly what you just said, and it's there's definitely a selfish component to the way we created this business. As someone who lives in Northbrook, I realized I lived so close to some of the best restaurants in the country, and yet really had no access to it unless I really wanted to dedicate hours driving back and forth to the city, getting babysitters, all that kind of stuff. And I started to realize if there was a way we could bring those restaurants to the surrounding suburbs, I thought people would really enjoy it, and lo and behold, they do.
We just have a minute here, but if I get the app on my phone, does it work for all of the restaurants in the city and all of the suburbs in the area?
No, it's a little unique, John, because we're more like catering than on-demand ordering. So we do require that people pre-order by around 10 to 12 o'clock the day that they're looking for that order to take place. And we schedule these restaurants on specific days of the week in specific suburbs because everything we do is focusing on delivery efficiency so we can have one driver bringing 10 or 15 orders to those areas at one time versus just one order at one time. It helps the restaurants. It's more like catering. It helps the drivers because we can pay them a fair wage. And it helps us make the economics work because we're going ahead and delivering multiple orders at one time versus just one order.
Got it. How long has this been up and running?
We've been doing it for around 2.5 years now, really focusing on how to continue to make people happy, which we clearly do. We've got incredibly high reviews on Google, and now we're just looking to grow it and try to introduce ourselves to more and more people if we can.
Okay. I'll get the app, I'll order the food, and I'll talk to you again another day, but it's Dwell Social, right?
That's correct. DwellSocial.com.
DwellSocial.com. Alan, good luck. Good idea. Alan Shulman, the CEO.